This week, we welcome Dan Matthews, Director of Worldwide Sales Engineering from Constella Intelligence, to discuss digital risk protection. In the leadership and communications section, cybersecurity increasingly on audit committee agendas, CIO involvement in security grows as CEOs target risk reduction, how poor security culture leads to insider risk, and more. Business Security Weekly starts now.
This is Security Weekly, for security professionals by security professionals. Broadcasting live from G-Unit Studios in Rhode Island, it's the show where we explore the business of security to improve the security of business. Your trusted source for actionable insights on leadership, communication, and innovation. Get ready for Business Security Weekly.
Monitoring and maintaining compliance is a never-ending struggle with a high price of failure. FireMon helps customers meet complex and varying compliance requirements. FireMon has fully customizable reporting, analytics, assessments, and dashboards to meet the compliance needs of any organization. With FireMon, compliance reports take a tenth of the time, and real-time continuous compliance eliminates the anxiety and headaches of audit preparation. Improve security outcomes by improving security operations with FireMon. Visit securityweekly.com/FireMon to learn more. Every 11 seconds, there's a new ransomware attack. Oil pipelines, universities, corporations, all paying millions of dollars. Barracuda says, don't pay the ransom. Before a ransomware attack occurs, train your teams to recognize an attack and use anti-phishing technology. Protect your applications, and they can't get onto your network. Simple backup and restore solutions quickly recover your data without paying the ransom. Build your ransomware protection plan now by visiting securityweekly.com/Barracuda. That's securityweekly.com/Barracuda. People require access from anywhere to resources everywhere, but legacy security is ill-equipped for today's hybrid organization. AppGate SDP delivers zero-trust network access for hybrid workforces and workloads, empowering trusted users with secure, frictionless connections to only what they need. Make your attack surface invisible and reduce time to provision by 91% with AppGate SDP, a leader in the 2021 Forrester ZTNA New Wave. Learn more at securityweekly.com/AppGate.
Welcome to Business Security Weekly. This is episode number 248, recorded January 31st, 2022. I am your host, Matt Alderman, here in Colorado, but sporting the weather of the Northeast that got pounded with snow. Joining me remotely is my co-host, Mr. Jason Albuquerque, who had, what, 19 inches of snow, Jason?
Yeah, pretty darn close, Matt. It's snowy here in New England, but let me tell you, We had quite a football weekend to be sitting inside and watch some really, really good games. So, you know, I'm super excited. We have Smoking Joe Burrow, right? He's going out there. You know, the other hobby of some of us Security Weekly folks is smoking cigars. And if you know anything about Joe Burrow, he's a cigar aficionado himself. So I'm going Bengals, baby. I'm going Bengals.
So am I. I'm an Ohio kid, right? So born and raised, I still root for the Browns, even though they stink. But my second alternative is I got to root for Cincinnati. It's an Ohio team. So
right, got to go. Right. With so that's who my son were rooting for over the weekend. We got our wish. So to the Super Bowl, baby.
And joining me this week, filling in for Ben Carr, who happens to be in Boise, is Mr. Lee Neely.
Oh, wait a minute here. Do I need to go down and knock on his door to see what's going on?
No, I'm glad. I guess so.
Thanks for asking for help. Glad I could step in.
Yeah, I requested you on purposely because we're going to talk zero trust in the federal space is one of the articles. And I wanted your thoughts on this because we've talked about this before. So I'm glad you could fill in for Ben today. Do you have a specific guest or topic that you want us to cover on one of the shows? Submit your suggestions for guests by visiting securityweekly.com/guests and completing the form. We review suggestions monthly and we'll reach out to you once reviewed. Also, join us February 16th to learn about validation techniques within applications. Then join us on March 2nd to learn 5 things you can do to catch more bad guys. To register for these webcasts, please visit securityweekly.com/webcasts. And don't forget to check out our library of on-demand webcasts and technical trainings at securityweekly.com/on-demand. This segment is sponsored by Constella Intelligence. To learn more, please visit securityweekly.com/Constella. Dan Matthews brings over 20 years experience in the security industry to his role as Director, Worldwide Sales Engineering at Constella Intelligence. He has served in various technical, marketing, and advisory capacity roles at former companies including UUNet, MCI, Verizon, CyberTrust, and SecureWorks. Most recently, Dan led the global sales engineering team at Lastline for 5 years through a successful acquisition by VMware. Dan, welcome to Business Security Weekly.
Hey, Matt. Thanks for having me today. Appreciate it.
Yes, thanks for joining us. We're going to talk about digital risk protection. And I think what I want to start with is when I hear the term digital risk protection, the first thing that might pop to mind is third-party risk, attack surface monitoring. So let's start with what do we mean by digital risk protection first?
Yeah, so third-party risk and digital risk, or the attack surface monitoring is really about assets you have control over, where digital risk protection is about assets that may not be directly controlled by you. They're or your employees have gone out and signed up for an account at some site. Maybe it's related to work, maybe it's not related to work. Or data aggregators have gone out and bought your data from data brokers or found it on the surface web, and kind of mined that data together to build profiles on your executives, on your employees. And that data can be used against you as readily as your Amazon S3 buckets.
Right. So what I think is interesting about this segment is we're going to talk more about the people side of this, right? Like your executives, your employees, even potentially some of your organizational data that's sitting out in places that you don't really have control over, unlike third-party assets or even your cloud and external assets. I mean, this is a whole new class of threats and assets that have to be managed.
Absolutely correct. And again, it's kind of the outside the firewall. And firewall is probably the wrong way to say it because firewalls aren't really a thing anymore with everybody working from everywhere anymore. But really, it's if you think of an administrative boundary where you own and have control, administrative control of data, irrespective of the location of that data. But the DRPS space is largely built on data that you have no control over. So it's completely in the third party. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So let's walk through maybe a couple use cases. Social media accounts, right? My employees might have a social media account. My company might have a social media account as well. It's possible to leverage those accounts to impersonate someone or something and potentially use data that they collect to launch an attack. So that's one scenario. What are some of the other ones?
Yeah, so impersonation is a huge one. Think in terms of like somebody representing, hey, I'm the HR person from your organization, and please send resumes to me or I'll do some correspondence with you and use that as a springboard for phishing, account takeover, malware, ransomware. There's lots of ways in the impersonation angle. Further down the chain, the biggest one we talk about most frequently, and it feels like it's played out in our space, is the ransomware space, where if you roll back to several of the recent massive ransomware incidents, which have caused massive shutdown of infrastructure, can all be attributed back to a data breach from a third party. I think the 3.2 billion, the comb list, there was a big breach data set that got re-released. It was merging together multiple data sets back in the spring of 21. A couple of pretty large ransomware outbreaks were because a breach of a third-party site ended up causing the account credentials for a account to be that were still live, still valid, and still usable to authenticate to a VPN. So the bad guys, found the account name linked back to the company, a short step to link the company to where its VPN concentrator is. And then, they're an authenticated user on the network and Bob's your uncle, as they say.
So if you don't control these systems, how do you protect against these types of attacks? Like, what do you have to do to monitor and protect those profiles if you don't have control of the systems where that data is being used?
Yeah, it's all about early warning systems and using indicators. So building a system out that actually lets you know, when a new breach is disclosed or what's out there. Understanding the attack surface that your employees represent. So if you can, you know, gather data, facts about, you know, your employees, you do it already in your HR systems. You're collecting a physical address, email addresses. So the types of data that's out there in the wild that's being bandied about and sold for $20 a pop by data brokers includes, you know, your full name, your email address, your former employers, the cars you've bought. Elon Musk last week asked the guy that ran a Twitter bot to please turn off the Twitter bot that tells the world where my airplane is landing, because the tail fin numbers on airplane is a kind of matter of public record. And there's FAA databases which show where planes are taking off and landing all the time. So there's a lot of data out there in the wild that either you can't control, or if you can control it, you don't know how. And it's really building a system to actually break your employees down into their underlying attributes. You know, I am Dan Matthews. I have a physical address. I have former physical addresses. I own a number of automobiles. I, you know, have bank accounts. I have all these things, this digital detritus, this jet stream that sits behind me, that, you know, it is a liability. And, you know, all data is toxic over time. So controlling that jet stream and reducing that jet stream, or at least understanding that jet stream, helps the companies have, you know, gain an upper hand on, hey, a new data breach happened. Dan has an account at that site. You know, or we saw Dan's data in that site, let's do a precautionary reset of all Dan's passwords. Let's go ahead and reset authentication tokens. Let's audit his access logs for internet facing services to stay one step ahead rather than three steps behind bad things.
Yeah, I mean, to have this kind of information at hand is incredible, right? I mean, looking at it from employee and executive protection, from a you know, from fraud protection, from protecting the brand of your organization, and to have it in a platform gives you a level of economies of scale that I think is incredibly beneficial to an organization. Now, you know, some organizations, you know, I've had my team do it, you know, ourselves. It's a manual process with multiple tools or scripts or things going out there trying to gather as much threat intelligence as we can to protect the company and protect the employees and especially the executives. But it's a manual task to, you know, to be able to have a comprehensive system and platform that's going to bubble up the most important information to the top so we can be proactive has huge benefits, because having those siloed methods, it's not an efficient or effective process for security teams these days. So, you know, having that platform approach is incredible.
And NIST is a, you know, specified, you know, continuous monitoring for a long time, bestowing the virtues of inside the network continuous monitoring. So if you can break down your things about your brand, the attributes about your people, attributes about your brand, attributes about your supply chain, attributes about your locations, and just continually monitor that. So set up a continuous monitoring feed for that. It's a systems problem, and you can do scale out monitoring of that. The hard part, you know, I guess the easy part is kind of connecting the surface web. What gets harder is connecting to social media, connecting to the deep web, connecting to the dark web, and having the deep hooks in these spaces where, or Telegram channels, places where bad guys might be talking smack. So that's the harder piece. But yeah, absolutely, scale out model to monitor, you know, break down your business data into attributes, and then do continuous monitoring of those attributes wherever you can. And the next step beyond that is kind of difficult also, is applying a risk model to that to say, okay, when it came from Fox News or CNN, and it mentioned the CEO or a couple of attributes about the CEO, probably not a big deal. But if it was 4chan talking about the CEO, that might raise the stakes a bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, for sure. Oh, go ahead, Lee.
So I was wondering, I mean, it sounds like it's not just going out there and skimming the different sources out there. You've also, as a company, I'm going to be preceding some information that I care about as well. And is there a ranking then as well of what's, you know, what I provide versus what you've gathered, or is it all kind of going the pot together?
Well, the attributes are the attributes. So, I mean, you know, there's only so many things that make up the composite of Dan. And there's certain things we're not really actively collecting right now. So if I encounter Dan Matthews, and, you know, we know that Dan's a U.S. citizen because he has a U.S. address or U.S. locale. You know, so if I find a a numeric value in a, adjacent within an adjacency of that name that looks like a social, so 3, 2, 4, you know, that might, you know, score higher because, hey, that's suddenly a piece of possible sensitive information alongside attributes that are generally benign and out there in the wild. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, it kind of did, because I'm thinking about, you know, all the aspects of getting all that information to have it. I mean, you need your, I'm assuming the company's providing information to make things more relevant and also mm-hmm. in more authoritative source. Any trouble getting people saying, hey, that's you, I don't want to add to that that's already out there, or that who's going to watch this and make sure nothing happens to it?
Yeah, certainly. But again, the data is already out there. So we're encountering it in the wild. But yeah, there is some natural caution about doing this. For the executive class, it's not generally a problem because they already are pretty out there. Like the rock star CEOs are out there. So, you know, giving up that information is not so challenging. Getting information about the third, fourth, fifth house of the executive might be a little more cumbersome. Mm-hmm. But the other interesting bit is the tool is self-learning. The platform does learn and push information back in the hands of the analysts and says, hey, this address looks like it might belong to your person. Do you want to add this to their profile? So there is a self-learning nature over time as things happen, but certainly opting in, you know, minimally we need an email address and a full name for an employee, and usually a work email address is something that the business can justify and say, this is kind of our thing to manage. But the work can be that the platform like this can provide can go a lot deeper the more attributes we have about the employee. Former addresses, former email addresses, former phone numbers, all that type of stuff.
So Dan, we start to cross over into an interesting privacy area here, right? I mean, obviously this data is available out there. You're just aggregating it together. But what happens when somebody wants to get rid of this data or not have it monitored and tracked? Like, is there a way to do that? Because I think a lot of people are sitting here listening to this segment for a second going, wait a minute. You're like collecting all this stuff about me out in the that's available on the internet. Like, what if I don't want it out there? Can I like get rid of this data?
Yeah, absolutely. And if you think of it in terms of the people that are collecting your data, obviously, for most citizens in America and elsewhere, you know, the three big credit bureaus, the Experian, TRW, Equifax, plus you know some other random marketing organizations. So there's actually a cool website you can go to as a person, not necessarily a corporate thing, but as an individual, you can go to the Privacy Rights Clearinghouse, the same people that kind of track the data breaches that are announced all too often recently. But the Privacy Rights Clearinghouse, it's privacyrights.org. One of the resources they have at their site goes into vast detail about 350 different organizations you can visit. And many of them do have opt-out policies. And with the CCDA, the California Privacy Rights Act, I forgot what the name of the acronym stands for, but the Privacy Rights Act in California and elsewhere is picking up steam, allows you, the consumer, the right to not participate in these services. So you can actively opt yourself out.
Which I think is interesting. It kind of puts a hole in the whole protect the executive employee thing if the data is not there. But I mean, because if some new piece of information popped up, I mean, it would be a trigger for something that would be new or potentially
every time
malicious.
You do something, you know, in our world with open records in the public space, you get married, that triggers a document. You buy a piece of property, that triggers a document. You buy a car, that triggers a document creation. So the data is out there and continues to go out there every time you do something, unless you're working really aggressively to buy under a company name or a shell name or do something differently. All the work that we do online is being harvested and aggregated, bundled up, packaged and resold and resliced constantly. So it is a never-ending story. And again, I wonder if these data aggregators, the data we're talking about is surface web legitimate companies who are selling data and acting in the best interests of everybody. They're making their money, but they do honor the opt-out requests. What we're not talking about is underground data brokers who are doing the same thing and selling it in the underground space who will not honor an opt-out request. So there still exists, other dangers around this data as well.
Yeah, definitely. So customers? What are like the key use cases? Why would they make an investment in a platform like this? Can you walk through some of those kind of like key use cases for leveraging Constella Intelligence?
Indeed, yeah. The top three really are, you know, the easiest one, the account takeover. So when my employee's credential drops from a data breach from a third party, proactively reset passwords and trigger a small downstream automation, you know, SOAR type runbook to reset authentication tokens, audit access logs, let the employee know about the breach and what attributes of theirs were rolled up in the breach, and rinse and repeat every time the next breach happens. That's the simple, easy one. But also, you know, there are other credible threats to people. When employees get doxxed, when data shows up on Pastebin or one of the million different paste sites out there, when employee data shows up on the 4chans or forums, when people make harmful or incendiary comments about the executive doing things they didn't do, littlest comments on social media, there are actual takedown actions that need to happen for that type of stuff. There is brand problems, brand protection. So, you know, people showing up in marketplaces representing they're part of a brand that they're not really part of. So fraudulent goods and fraudulent apps and app stores. There's lots of use cases that cross the marketing side of the house, the security CISO side of the house, and also the physical security. When activist groups want to protest outside your building, you know, maybe the security office wants to tell the employees, we'll do a light load this week or light load that day when the protest happens. That way you're reduce the risk of a physical altercation.
Yeah, Dan, that was actually something I was going to bring up as I was going through use cases in my mind. My head went to like global risk resilience, right? Where if I'm a company with international offices, if there's any type of political unrest happening within a country that I may have an office, getting that level of intelligence to see that, right? And proactively be able to do something about it or communicate to employees or, you know, get your folks out of Dodge if it gets that bad. So that Absolutely. Was one of the use cases I actually thought of was global risk resilience outside
and
of the
beyond that supply chain too. We've seen supply chain problems the last couple of years, right? So understanding when there's, you know, a physical disaster in an area where you have critical facilities. So staying on top of that's also important.
Yeah, I think the challenge is, you know, there's so much activity that goes on outside. How do you gather that effectively? We think about threat intelligence, but not in threat intelligence necessarily in this way, like around your employees or around your physical locations or even to your executives. Because yep. I remember growing up as a kid, my mom was a loan officer at a bank, and they always walked us through this scenario, like, you know, we don't want you out wandering around because, you know, I think there was fear that, you know, somebody might kidnap me for a ransom or something like that. And I always thought it was silly. But think about what you could do with an executive or executive's children or relatives to create some, you know, campaigns or ransomware or, you know, like different events that you would want to protect against if they were going on with your executive team.
And a lot of the bigger companies we work with, you know, they do provide protection, not just to the chief executives, but also the family members. And what we heard from them was they do like a point in time digital footprint analysis, which was as good as it was since, you know, what's changed since last time we ran this. And it wasn't continuous monitoring. So, you know, when Facebook changes a feature and the privacy settings you set a year ago are reverted, and now the executive's child is posting photos where the family is and you know, compromising the safety of the family at a international location, that is a real credible problem. So that's another thing that we work really hard to help get in the hands of the right analysts, kind of distill all that information across surface web, deep web, dark web, social media, and pull that back to a single platform and a single pane of glass that we can slice up for view by the various teams, whether it's the marketing team, the CISO's, you know, security team to reset passwords and notify employees about, you know, possible phishing attacks coming their way, or the physical security team for the organization.
Yeah. Was there a question there?
Go ahead.
I was going to ask, like, how do you get started? Like, how easy, how fast is this to bring a system like this online? I assume the data's there, so it's the onboarding is more about identifying key executives, employees that you want to start monitoring. Is it that simple, or Clint, walk us through the steps?
Yes, absolutely. So minimally, we need a full name and email address. Obviously, that kind of limits what we hit, but maximally, data, HR type data, so physical addresses, former and current phone numbers, cell phone, landlines, former numbers, former work numbers, former work email addresses. All these things are kind of a composite of attributes of the employee's life, a digital composite of the digital jet stream behind the employee. And we use that to help find chatter and prioritize that chatter as well, and really disambiguate that, is my John Doe the right John Doe, or is it some other John Doe? So that's what the magic behind the platform really is, to figure out the right person. So from the customer, we need just a list of employees and their attributes. And the systems work is all handled in the middle by our tooling. And then the output, we do have a default threat model, but that threat model can be overridden. We can feed into whatever work systems and workflows the customer already has. So if they're already using a SOAR or SIM platform, we can lift and shift notifications out that way. If they're more of a ServiceNow, ticketing type organization, we can lift and shift out that way. And then pivot back into us for details and other workflow management.
What percentage of the work do you find the company can't insource the remediation of those? I mean, reset all your passwords. Usually they can do that, but you're finding things that need to be like a posting takedown or something. Is that a separate service or?
Yeah, have you found the phone number for Facebook to call for help?
If I did, I don't think I'd call.
So that's the problem, right? So a lot of these Web 2.0 and Web 3.0 companies, there is no phone number to call for help, right? And it's a lightly staffed organization that's overwhelmed. So I think, an org like ours having deep hooks into these companies and, showing that we have a chain of custody to perform this action, takedown action on their behalf, on behalf of the customer, does help to increase the likelihood of taking down, particularly the salacious content or libelous content, but also impersonation type events, like where people try to, and there's a thin line between parody and actual malice. But again, we help to navigate the customer through that to make it so we take that take the bad stuff away. So yes, the takedown part, takedown is also part of the process, and that's really an important part as well.
Well, actually, there's a big thing there because. Sorry, I was going to say, takedown today versus takedown a year ago is completely different. I'd rather have an expert that actually knows what the hell they're doing than attempt to do it myself.
Indeed. And again, sometimes it's a knowledge transfer also, where it's like they open a ticket and say, hey, data's out in the dark web, take it down. Well, it doesn't work exactly that way. But there are places, on the surface and in certain locations where, it is easier, but still not easy to do takedowns. So. And that's what we're here to help out with.
Yeah. So what other telemetry can you monitor, right? You were talking about names and titles, email addresses, physical addresses, things of that nature. When my mind starts to spin to think about, intellectual property theft. If I had Albuquerque Industries and I had my, super secret IP going out there, my Jason sauce that I'm trying to put out there to the world, could I monitor for that? Could I look at code names of my intellectual property and start looking for intellectual property theft?
Absolutely. And more modules are being deployed for brand protection, for threat actor tracking. If you find a moniker of somebody talking smack about your CEO on Twitter, would you like to keep an eye on that person for a period of time?
Yeah.
Yes, all the above. So as long as you can break it down, the at its core, the technology is not rocket science. It's persistent search, but you have to know where to look under which rocks. And complexity comes with deep web, dark web, and social media, being able to be into places to peer in under those rocks.
That's great. Thank you.
So Jason, you can protect your super secret barbecue sauce, I guess.
That's it. That's it. I learned from the best. You know, my good friend, the barbecue man.
Yes, I do. Mr. Fredrickson. Yes. Dan, thank you so much for joining us on Business Security Weekly.
Matt, Jason Lee, thank you guys. Appreciate it.
If you want to learn more about how to protect your executives and employees or about Constella Intelligence, please visit securityweekly.com/Constella. We're going to take a quick break and then cover the leadership and communications articles for this week.
Account takeovers, malicious campaigns, impersonation, and data breaches are on the rise, driven by the pandemic and security challenges of a remote workforce. The number one most common attack vector in breaches is compromised credentials. Constella Intelligence protects your key employees from digital risk by continuously monitoring the deep, dark, and surface web for exposed credentials, detecting threats that others miss with real-time alerts to protect you and your company from a targeted attack. Try it free at securityweekly.com/Constella. Let's face it, cyber attackers have the advantage. ExtraHop is on a mission to help you take it back. Regain the upper hand with security that can't be undermined, outsmarted, or compromised. When you don't have to choose between protecting your business and moving it forward, that's security uncompromised. See how it works in the full product demo, free online at securityweekly.com/ExtraHop. Cyber risk and compliance automation is finally here. Legacy GRC systems cannot support the powerful, real-time automation and oversight that organizations require to take risks that matter to succeed. CyberSync continuous control automation ingests data from the IT GRC stack to update controls against regulatory requirements and risks in real time, delivering insights and visibility. See how members of the Fortune 500 are saving millions annually by visiting securityweekly.com/CyberSync.
Welcome back to Business Security Weekly. I am your host, Matt Alderman, joined by Jason Albuquerque and Lee Neely. Don't miss any of your favorite Security Weekly content. Visit securityweekly.com/subscribe to subscribe to any of our podcast feeds and have all new episodes downloaded right to your phone. You can now also join our mailing list, Discord server, and follow us on social media and our streaming platforms. CRA's Business Intelligence Unit has launched its next survey on Zero Trust. What are your barriers to Zero Trust implementation? We're actually going to cover an article on this in this segment. Take our survey and enter to win a $500 Tango gift card by visiting securityweekly.com/Zero Trust. Report results will be released at our upcoming Zero Trust eSummit in March. All right, gentlemen, to the articles. We do have one on Zero Trust, which is why I wanted Lee here. But before we get there, audit committee, increasingly focused on cybersecurity. Really? Wow.
Get used to it, people. Every committee needs a cybersecurity expert at this point. I mean, come on. You know, it's one of those scenarios where it's probably one of the, well, probably definitely one of the largest business risks out there in an organization today. So expect your board of directors to start having cybersecurity experts, your audit committees. Any business related committee that you're going to spin up, you should have a cybersecurity expert on it.
Go ahead, Lee. No.
I was saying I have a similar but slightly twisted take on it because I was just had a meeting this morning with my CISO, and he was looking at something very similar, and he says, you know, we're going to need more cyber analysts who are sitting there looking at the regulatory requirements and what we're doing and helping us find, test, and close the gaps. But they're looking at it from the, you know, what are the auditors coming at us from, as opposed to coming at it from best security practices. We need both. But I thought that was a little slightly different than what Jason's saying. But yeah, we need more cyber brains at the table. That's a given. And yeah, people willing to roll up their sleeves.
And that's where I was starting to go, Lee, because I remember back in the early days of Graham Leach Bliley in the regulatory side, in the shift by the IT auditors to start to look at security, right? Here we are 20 years later almost, and we're having the same conversation at the audit committee. And I guess my question is, do these audit committees have the security expertise to actually know what they should be looking for? Because it's not just about the regulatory aspects, which you bring up, Lee, which are important. But that's not the only risk associated with cybersecurity in the space. And are people thinking holistically about the business risk aspects of security, or do we still have some big gaps?
Yeah, I mean, I think from my perspective, you know, they're not looking at it today. I think that's why the need is there, right? So to have an executive level cybersecurity expert on your audit committee is going to give a perspective that hasn't been there. Right? We're going to be looking at supply chain risk. We're going to be looking at internal risk, right? That threat vector from the inside. We're going to be looking at all of these different aspects to business risk and business resilience overall. that's never been on these audit committees before because they've been financially focused. So
right.
I think it's essential that we take part in these conversations.
Yeah, we just had a segment on digital risk. What's the risk to the executive? What's the risk coming from the employee side?
Like, 100%.
Is the audit committee even thinking about this?
Physical security. I mean, think about it. We were talking physical security as well. You know, are our locations safe that are around the world? You know, is there any type of unrest around the world that we have to be thinking of it, you know, from a financial perspective? Yeah, we need that level of perspective on these audit committees to bring those conversations to the table.
I mean, we're seeing it at the. We're starting to see the cybersecurity expertise come into the board. Mm-hmm. My guess is you're going to see that same trend continue down to the audit committees that are reporting to the board, so that there are relevant security risks included in those audits as they roll up. I guess that's good for us old curmudgeons that have been in the industry for a while. As we're looking for a retirement job, we'll just go sit on a bunch of audit board committees. A
bunch of boards, right? Seriously. I mean, at the end of the day, if there's a trickle-down effect, if it starts at the board of directors and now the board of directors are putting, you know, putting some pressure down on their advisory committees, yeah, no, absolutely, I want that, right? So start putting those cybersecurity experts at the board level. That way they can start looking at all of these different committees that they have, advisory committees, audit committees, and say, well, where's your cyber expertise, right? And start asking the right questions and putting pressure downstream. Need it.
Yep. Yeah, agreed.
Keep their feet to the fire.
Yeah. 100%. Yeah. Now, the law of unintended consequences always happens, right? Because now there's going to be more and more mandates from the board, more and more mandates from the C-level executives. Do we have the IT talent to actually be in place to remediate those? That's a whole other conversation.
Perfect segue into the next article, because we're going to talk mandates and keeping feet to the fire. OMB issues their zero trust strategy. Lee, we talked about this when a couple months back when you came on, we were talking about zero trust and what are going to be some of the challenges. So OMB comes out and sets a timeline. Within 30 days from the publication, by January 26, you need to designate and identify a zero trust strategy implementation leader. Okay, that's pretty easy. You name a body. Within 60 days or March 26, agencies must build on the mandated plans by incorporating the additional requirements spelled out. Okay, so you got to have your plan and then have it fully implemented by the end of 2024. Like, really? Right. Like, are there funds available for the agencies to actually execute on this timeline?
Yeah. Unfunded mandates. The beauty of the government.
So the original executive order, 14028, which just jumps on, implied there would be funding for the initiatives. And to date, we're at least, we're 6-8 months out now, there's been zero funding identified and released. But the timelines haven't changed, the requirements haven't changed. And, you know, I mean, I get it, the old moat and drawbridge model doesn't work with today's adversaries, but if you want to switch the entire federal government in 2.5 fiscal years to zero trust, that's a pretty tall order. I don't think it's going to happen by the end of 24, but I'd like to see us make progress, but I just don't think, particularly without funding, lots of funding.
Yeah. And to be honest with you, with that unrealistic timeline, that means nothing's going to be done to quality, because they're just going to be rushing to put checks in a box, which I definitely don't appreciate as a security leader, right?
No.
You know, typically when you make goals, you want them to be achievable, right? So why don't we sit back and make some achievable goals here? Now, the one thing I will say, as I'm impressed, is that they actually used CISA's model and didn't create their own, right? Because, you know, part of what we see in the government is every department wants to create their own model. So I'm glad there's not an OMB zero trust model that they have to follow to create more silos.
There was actually a couple of good things slipped into that memo as well. One was that on our national security systems, they need to follow the 863-3. You know, the get away from password complexity, use long passphrases and make sure you don't have things in a breach. But on a classified system, that's a little harder. But basically moving up the password guidance to today's requirements was good. Also, in preparation for zero trust, they had previously issued a directive that all external facing websites had to use HSTS and HTTPS for their transactions. They now added everything on the inside of your firewall. Realistically, if you're going to zero trust, you can't have the network DMARC anymore. You can't trust the firewall. That except for, I still believe there's some specific use cases like OT that's going to have a firewall. But
so pretty much full end-to-end encryption, right?
Yes, yes. They want encryption. They wanted all systems encrypted in transit and at rest across the federal government by November 8, 2021. And they actually also had encryption in use originally there as well, meaning you have, you know, an encrypted column in a database, for example, protect information. It's only decrypted when used. I think that deadline went flying by. So, yeah. But it's a good idea to do these things. I'm not saying these shouldn't be done. I'm just saying I don't know how to do it at the speed of government.
Right. Especially when it's not funded.
Right. I mean, we've been doing funding. I mean, you know, you can do laptops with encryption. We've been doing that for a few years now, but a lot of desktops don't even have a TPM chip, so it becomes more interesting.
Yeah. What I love about the architecture is it just validates my app user data discussion. Because I said, these were the three criticals. Now you add devices and network to it and you have the zero trust model, but it does give you a pretty good idea of where to make investments. I think as a CISO and as an organization, these are things that are important. However, I'm not sure the government can move that fast when they don't have the money to do it. And you know, these are complex systems across these five core domains. Yeah.
Right. And I mean Lee just presented a great point. Technical debt, right? Can they afford to get rid of the technical debt that they have in place by that timeline? Most likely not. Right. Yep. So you're gonna have to create some level of a roadmap to be able to address the technical debt that's there. You may have legacy systems, applications, devices, right? So you have to take that into account.
Yeah. Yep. By the way, the executive order also applies to national security systems as well. There was a memo last week that also changed that scope. Originally, it was only for unclassified. I'm not sure about the accelerated cloud adoption for national security systems. That probably translates to common services as opposed to connecting them to the internet. But there's good architecture out here, and NIST is working on like 19 different models for implementations for agencies to leverage to get to zero trust. So it's not a greenfield as much, but I still think time is going to be the challenge.
Yeah, and I agree with you. Yeah, always. What is it? Time, speed, quality. Right. What? Pick two. You can't have all three.
Yeah, three.
That's right.
Right. Yeah. Absolutely.
CIOs are seeing prioritized security because CEOs are trying to reduce risk. Now, what's interesting about this article is very focused on the CIO. I made a case at the end of last year that the CIO should report to the CISO. So isn't this just ultimately the CISO's responsibility?
Yep. That's exactly where I was going to go with this, Matt. I mean, you read my mind. We've had these conversations, you know, long enough to know that, you know, we're in a position now where I truly believe the CISO should be pulling those puppet strings there, honestly. Right. So, yeah. You know, I had some issues with this article. I don't think it empowered the CISO enough. I think they talk too much about the CIO and the CTO being in control. It's a scenario where you know, I'm the evangelist for the CISO. So this is where the CISO should have a seat at the table and have the ability to influence across the board.
Yeah, agreed.
Without risk of influence, right? Influence from a CTO who has an agenda, influence from a CIO who has an agenda. And the agenda for those folks aren't always security. It's not always security.
Yeah, that's true. That was always the kind of the intrinsic challenge with the CISO reporting to the CIO, because the CIOs, they were all about availability. They didn't care about the rest necessarily.
That's right.
So,
that's right.
Yeah. Two new banking requirements coming into play. I thought these were interesting, right? The first one is banking organizations must notify their primary federal regulator of any computer security incidents that rises within 36 hours. So, you know, that's pretty fast turnaround for security incident. Which means your SIM and your SOARs are going to be busy, you know, pulling all this data together and tracking things. The second one is a bank service provider must notify each affected banking organization as soon as possible when provider determines it's experienced a computer security incident. Now, I think this is really interesting because having worked on the third party side for a bank, knowing the number of service providers that support some of these banking organizations, holy cow, that's a huge amount of work because anytime something happens to their systems, think about all the notifications in the downstream banks that have to be notified of breaches.
I know. And I mean, from the article, it basically says that at the time the organization determines that there's a notification incident, the ticker starts.
Yeah.
Right. So the second you have that epiphany of, oh my God, I think we may have to start notification, timer's on. Holy crap. 36 hours from there, baby.
I'm used to that kind of language coming from the .gov space. We do have, once it's determined that you actually have an instance, the clock starts coming down and you got to look at your federal and state requirements for reporting because you might have to report to both. I'm glad that they've, tried to define these things a little bit and they're not so vague. But I'm also looking at this going, hey, we put language in our contract with our cloud providers. If they have an incident, they better freaking tell us. I would think that wouldn't be that foreign in the banking industry, but your comment, Matt, leads me to believe that might be.
Yeah, I mean, think about a lot of these contracts that you have with your third-party service providers. They may or may not have some of those clauses in there. This is something now that has to be managed much more holistically across the organization. And if you see it here in banking, the question is, when does it come to healthcare and some of the other industries over time? This is kind of the early warning signal for some of those other industries potentially too.
I would say if you're in the cyber business, you ought to be talking to your supply chain management folks about standard cyber provisions to go into your contracts, and then look at, get those figured out, and then start looking at modding contracts that need to have them. Do it now. I mean,
retroactively, that
do that. It actually, my supply chain people said, what do you mean it's hard to mod the contract? I can do whatever we need to. Don't worry about it. Let's get it right. That was a good answer.
Right. Yeah, it doesn't happen that fast. Trust me.
It does not. It takes time, but willingness to work it makes it go faster.
Yeah. We have some cyber insurance news this week. We've been talking about some of the challenges with people getting cyber insurance going forward. There's been so many claims. This is an interesting interpretation of a lawsuit against a cyber insurance claim that was initially declined by the insurer that was then overturned in the appeals court. And the reason I brought this in is if you get cyber insurance and you're expecting certain things to be covered, and then they come back and say, well, no, that's not part of the coverage. One of two things is wrong. Either it's not clear in the policy, or you're just outright trying to deny the claim. So this litigation gets interesting because it actually overturns the insurer's decline of the actual component because of some terminology in the way it was structured in the cyber insurance policy. So even if cyber insurance is a challenge for organizations to get, what I hope we get is more clear policies going forward about what is and what is not covered.
Yeah, right. And as I started reading the article and I saw when it hit district court and they actually sided with the insurance company, I had that, oh shit moment, right? But then getting down into the article more, once they went to the Federal Court of Appeals and it got reversed, that made me a little bit more happy about what was going on. But it just shows you that you have to go through the process because ultimately if they settled at district court, what was it, like $200,000 or something like that? They would have been in the hole somewhere around there.
Yeah. Yeah. And plus their policy and all the other stuff, right? I mean, if you're paying for something and then it doesn't get paid, I mean, yes, you have to fight this in a legal battle. At the end of the article, it says, worst case scenario is you don't get something covered that you pay for. The second worst the second worst case scenario is you have to go to court to actually get it paid for and pay all the legal fees to get payment.
Right, right. And honestly, the use case that was here, I don't think either of you or anybody listening to this would ever think it wouldn't be covered by cyber liability insurance. I mean, think about it. An email comes into an employee. It's literally social engineering the employee. They get off the phone. They do a wire transfer. It's fraudulent, but the insurance company didn't want to cover it. That's something innately I would think would be covered, right?
I mean, yeah, this isn't like, you know, you called us for cyber fraud when this should have been covered by your building coverage or something. This is like, No, that's not even anyway connected. I had I've talked to somebody who they had the wrong insurer they contact for what they thought was the incident. When they dug down into it, it was justifiably wrong. It wasn't the type of instance that insurer covered, which was a learning experience. They went to the right one. But this feels like this was right in the sweet spot of cyber coverage. And what the hell?
Right. Exactly right. Yeah. Next article on communication and leadership, the who, what, and why of communications. And, you know, you can see the different segments. You know, the last paragraph to me was just a little telling. Like, our teams deserve a stronger response from us as leaders. Yes. Right. So we need to spend more time considering possible roads to our solutions. Solving management dilemmas requires more than just one approach. Solving a problem is as diverse as there are people on Earth. And when we're talking hybrid, how you do that, via what channels you do that, has all shifted in the past 2 years. The number of meetings I sit on is crazy. Like, and Jason, I know you and Lee probably have the same experience. Not every channel works for everybody, and you've got to make your adjustments to keep your team engaged and continue to drive leadership. And I think it's just challenging for everybody.
And the other challenge that we're seeing too, and this is why we have to be extremely diligent as leaders and making sure we're connected and building those relationships, is, I mean, look at the newswire. We're in the middle of the Great Recession or whatever we want to call this, but I'm seeing it. I'm seeing it with our customers. I'm seeing it in organizations I used to work for. People, over the course of the pandemic, people are starting to look at their lives and they're looking at their jobs and saying, you know what? I need balance. I need way more balance. And they're making decisions that they wouldn't have necessarily made 2 years ago to strike that work-life balance. And if we're not providing that level of a experience as leaders, that shows them that we care about them, we want to have relationships with our employees, we want to make sure we're taking care of their work-life balance needs, they're going to bolt, they're going to be gone, and we're going to lose really, really good employees. So that's another business challenge that folks really need to look into, because it's real. It is happening.
It is. We just experienced a couple of them in the last couple of days. You know, and every organization is going to face this in some form or fashion.
100%.
Last article, how poor cybersecurity culture can lead to insider risk. It's kind of on the same thread, right? We were just talking through, right? I love the first one. We need to shut down the Department of No.
You know what? I mean, we've talked about it a million times on the show. In order for us to have a seat at the table and be respected at that seat of the table, we have to show that we're a customer service-centric organization as a security team. Number one, right? We're there to enable the business. We're there to enable the employees. We are there to help guide the organization to an outcome with a security-first mindset. If we're not viewed as that, we will never have a seat at the table. We will be shunned from the seat at the table if we do. So we have to have a positive customer service centric organization always. People need to be very comfortable coming to us with a problem, even if it's a false positive. I would rather you raise your hand for something that may not necessarily be a threat than not raise your hand for something that was.
Right. We need to reward people for good behavior and stop, yelling at them for bad behavior, because we need positive reinforcement. If we continue the negative enforcement around this, we're never going to build a strong security culture. And the article talks about a little bit, like, give out a free, coffee card for every time somebody reports a phishing attack or whatever. We want to reinforce the positive and get away from the negative.
Yeah, 100%.
How many times I've been there where the program is coming in, I said, this scene. And I thought, and I'll say, well, wait a minute. I think we could figure out how to do this securely. Just let's pick this apart and figure out what needs to be done, what we can do to mitigate the risk. And they look at me like I'm from Mars, because they thought that I was going to say, no way in hell. Well, no, if they need to do their jobs, we got to figure it out, not say no.
You know, it's something that you sit back and you say, let's take a look at the outcome they are trying to achieve, right? That's the end game. Because, you know, we're all human and you know, we come at things and saying, I need, right? I need this solution. I need whatever. But in many instances, just having that one sentence that says, all right, well, let's sit down and talk about the outcome you're trying to achieve.
Yep.
Getting that deep and understanding what the end result is supposed to be. You know, I've told so many leaders that I've worked with, you know what? You're trying to cruise down I-95 at 110 miles an hour. I think we need to take 295 right now, which is a little bit of side road. It's going to take you a little bit longer, right? It's going to take you a little bit to get around it and to build this out the right way. But you're going to get to that destination. You're going to get there effectively, efficiently, right? So, right. So talking about that outcome and everybody agreeing on that outcome is huge.
Yeah, agree.
And then delivering against it once you've agreed right. to it. See, that's the other thing that's going to get us in a lot of trouble as leaders and especially cybersecurity leaders, right? Yep. If we've identified the outcomes and we have an approach, then we better be able to deliver on that. Because I see this in business in general, right? We set an expectation of what our outcomes are. You put together a model to be able to meet that, and then you don't execute against the model.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way you're going to achieve the outcome if you're not doing the foundational work based on right. the model to get to the outcome.
You got to walk the walk, right? And otherwise, it tarnishes the brand. You can sit there and talky-talky all day long, but is that what you want to be viewed as a leader, as a department? As a department right. who just talks their way through a problem and never resolves the problem? No, you got to walk the walk.
You have got to walk the walk. You have to perform. And performance, I think, is one of the biggest challenges these days is building a plan and executing against that plan and showing the performance against that plan. That is what will continue to keep our leaders right. in the seats that they need to continue to help organizations secure themselves.
It's all about trust, right? It's all about trust.
Yep.
Yes, it is. Lee, Jason, thank you so much for joining me today. Thank you, everyone, for watching and listening. We'll see you next week on Business Security Weekly.